Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 13th of April, as we record. We are back in the FT studios after last week's Easter-enforced decampment. And we have a pared-down team this week. Joining me in said studio is Ideas editor Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm not bad. And yourself?
All good. All good.
Fresh from running into the office today, as you revealed just now. Raring to go.
It's quicker than 63, boss.
And further afield, over the phone from Edinburgh, is Consumer Industries writer Chris Akers. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Dan. How's it going?
Very well, very well. We're going to talk about Tesco in our result of the week. We will also discuss the concept of greedflation, which has made its way into policy circles lately. That's quote-unquote greedflation. And we're going to look at whether the likes of consumer staples really are price gouging and examine what all of that might mean for investors. Then we turn to another consumer-facing business, PZ Cousins, which had a trading update today. It's not all shopping, though. We're also going to be chatting about our cover story this week, written by Alex, which attempts to establish what the next big market story might be following on from tech's dominance over the past decade. We start, however, with Tesco. Full-year figures out this morning. Chris, once again, they look pretty good under the circumstances.
Yeah, it was quite a resilient performance from Tesco. As you'd guessed from the market reaction this morning, the shares were up by over 2%. So higher prices drove revenues up by 7% in the year, but profits more than halved to just £1 billion this time around because of inflationary cost pressures and almost £1 billion of impairment charges due to higher interest rates. And that was mostly on property assets. But yeah, quite a strong set of results. I think one reason is Tesco's strong value proposition. The company said it's currently the most competitive it's ever been on prices. It's inflated behind the market and it's sort of maintained market share through doing that. Got several things on the go, like the Aldi price match and its club card price approach. Takes around 27% of UK market share and is actually the only full-line grocer to have grown share against pre-pandemic levels. And analysts seem quite bullish on management's guidance for this new 2024 financial year. Barclays called it reassuring, which I think is right. So the board expects flat retail cash profits this year, and that's just ahead of market consensus. And also expects retail free cash flow to come in within target. So I think, given cost pressures, a pretty strong set of results.
Yeah, as you say, I think it was the EBIT was coming in for the next financial year anticipated to be flat, which, as with everything now, is in the context, that is a good result because there is a lot of pressure on the likes of Tesco, given food inflation is still at elevated double-digit levels. Booker as well, something we've talked about Tesco in the past on this show. We don't always talk about Booker, the catering side, if you will, or the business that feeds into the catering side. That had a very strong year as well, which chimes with what we've seen from a slightly different angle, but the likes of Compass in recent months too, catering, pretty big growth driver at the moment.
Yeah, so Booker sales were up by 12%. That was a standout for Tesco in the year. So Booker sales up at around 8.7 billion on the back of catering market share gains. And Tesco took over 450 net new retail partners in the year. The company pointed to higher out-of-home consumption after the pandemic as one driver behind that.
Yeah, the sort of out-of-home, in-home dynamic for Tesco is interesting. Booker addresses one side of that. Clearly, as a supermarket, most of the attention is on the in-home side of things. There was a note from Jefferies the other day, which we were discussing beforehand, talking about the current pressures on the UK consumer and how, given the relative resilience of retail sales, it looks like grocers are taking a decent share of that, and perhaps a growing share as some out-of-home activities are scaled back and people perhaps overcompensate, that's not meant pejoratively, by spending a bit more on kind of in-home goods. So that might be a string to Tesco and other supermarkets' bow, a sorely needed one in the months ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's an interesting trend, as Jeffrey's points out, due to sort of cost of living pressures, etc. So grocers have taken some share from out of home for the first time in a couple of years, I think. Tesco, but yeah, there's a lot going on there. So Tesco, for example, flags in the results that UK retail volumes were actually down because of higher levels of in-home consumption last year. So there are some very tough comparatives to deal with here, even though things could be moving in the right direction.
Mm, that is true. I suppose the start of 2022 is still very much a pandemic-affected time, so those comparators will be difficult. But yes, there is some sort of hard data here. I think the Jefferies note was based on Barclaycard sales. And also Tesco's own market share data is based on Kantar figures, so it's not just the company, not solely the company blowing its own trumpet. But the year ahead, there are other challenges, some of which, again, we've discussed before, but the most crucial obviously relate to food inflation and how Tesco both deals with that, but also deals with suppliers. And that, I think, could be a particular issue in the weeks and months ahead, partly because of this topic we'll come on to in a bit more detail in a minute. This idea that companies are not just protecting margins, but using inflation to raise margins. There are a couple of academic papers on this, focused on the US earlier this year. But that concept, if you will, of greedflation has started to percolate in central bank circles even as well. Both the Bank of England and the European Central Bank have talked about it in recent weeks, which makes a bit of a change from the wage price spiral emphasis that they had before. To cut a long story short, from Tesco's point of view, you know, they're at the forefront of price rises in most consumers' minds. That's where consumers see the significant increases in the price of goods in most cases. They obviously will therefore be putting as much pressure as they can on suppliers, and even more so as commodity prices start perhaps to roll off or to roll over this year. We've seen that last year with Heinz and Tesco. Could we see more of the same this year? Was there much in there today, Chris, about the pressure they're trying to put on suppliers, talking a good game perhaps?
Yeah, well, the chief executive, Ken Murphy, referenced this in the results. He spoke about the unprecedented levels of inflation in the prices we have paid our suppliers for their products. And as you say, there's a lot going on behind the scenes, behind the big grocers like Tesco and suppliers. Examples, as you say, like Heinz last year. And there has been some controversy recently with Tesco. So the company told suppliers last month that they have to pay a new fulfillment fee when the supermarket sells its products online. And that really didn't go down well with suppliers. Shore Capital, interestingly, referred to this as a very uncharacteristic blunder by Tesco. And he said, "We sense backtracking has been immense. So that is something to watch going forward."
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's perhaps a sign of all sides looking to eke out whatever they can in terms of, you know, revenue lines and in terms of making sure the bottom line is stable. As I say, we'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a second, but I did see some suggestion before these results that the buyback, the 750 million buyback, which Tesco has restarted or announced today, might be delayed because of the kind of political pressures that might be coming on supermarkets. You know, maybe if last year was a story of energy price inflation, this year could be a story where food price inflation is at the forefront. And as we know, supermarkets have very thin margins. It's not really a suggestion that Tesco has been unduly hiking prices, but clearly it also feels confident enough to carry on with that buyback rather than trying to sneak it out to when the coast is slightly clearer, as it were.
Yeah, and the market obviously responded well to that buyback announcement today. I think as a general point, it is important to say that obviously it's still a very difficult time for the grocers. As we mentioned earlier, food inflation is still very elevated. So the latest Kantar data showed that annual UK grocery prices were up by a record 17.5% in March. So it obviously isn't surprising that companies are trying to recover costs and inflation. But yeah, but we'll come on to greedflation, as you say.
Yeah, I think whenever we talk about Tesco in the past year on this show, you know, the results have always been very good. In between that, because of the obvious pressures on the sector, the share price doesn't particularly, you know, go anywhere. Even being flat is quite good in this environment. But that also probably supports the buyback, I think, as well, in that the company is confident it's throwing off a lot of cash. They're reasonably confident they're not buying shares at what they would, or what many people would see as an overvalued level. So it supports that decision. Alex, bring you in on Tesco. Well, what's your kind of overall sense of their performance, the status of the company as it currently stands?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as ever with grocers, it's a really delicate balance. I mean, I read through the results, and it's hard not to admire Tesco's ability to turn a profit given the complexity of the job. You know, operationally, it's very impressive, even if the reward is, you know, is quite slight. I suppose on the political question, I would wonder what the attack line would be. I mean, if we're talking about grocers in the round here, and Tesco is, you know, is pretty indicative of the sector, given that they are the largest. And they are, you know, they're kind of leading from the front on some of the measures they've introduced to combat the, you know, the rise, which has continued, of the German discounters. I mean, they made £2 billion free cash flow this year against £66 billion of retail sales. That combines fuel, and that's gone up a lot in the last year. But, I mean, it's not clear to me, you know, certainly compared to, you know, the water companies or the energy suppliers, that these are in any way egregious profits. And when you look at some of the stories coming out of the trade press, and just the relationship, the very, very delicate balance that Tesco has to strike with its suppliers, it is clear that, you know, a lot of the profit is in the way they balance their working capital, and also their, you know, their relationships with the large suppliers. So, I mean, this story last week, I think it's first reported by the grocer, but it's picked up everywhere and confirmed by Tesco, that they've told some of their suppliers, their largest suppliers, to book it, and the online store, that they're going to need to stop paying a new fulfillment charge if they want to be on Tesco shelves. I mean, their fulfillment costs are growing. Their operations are now so complex in trying to meet this, you know, this everywhere, all the time, always on, a customer demand and across their enormous range, that they have taken the decision to basically extract fees from large suppliers, implicitly threatening that they're going to pull their products if they don't cough up. So clearly they don't want to raise retail prices for customers. And it also suggests to me that in the main they think some of their suppliers have protected their margins a bit more easily than they've been able to. So that jostle's going to play out, I think, probably behind the scenes a bit more than the, you know, the potential political football that we've seen some other sectors become. That's my rough take on the yeah. business.
I think I would certainly agree with that. I suppose I was thinking back to pandemic mutterings about whether, you know, those profits were, you know, that was kind of the first time for a while when we'd seen grocers come into that kind of political sphere. It didn't really get very far, but some suggestion that those profits were, you know, potentially the target for a windfall. Now, given food price inflation is so high, you know, people are shocked when they look at the price of things on shelves. You could see it becoming a political football, even though, as you say, you know, I think they're doing quite a creditable job and there's not really much they can do. Let's turn to some of those suppliers. This idea of, you know, the margins are, well, certainly, you know, they have an easier job of it on margins than the supermarket's margins are typically quite a bit higher. But the question of whether these margins are unjustly high and whether they're using high input costs to add a bit on top and passing that on. We had a look at the operating margin of the big consumer staples companies over the past couple of years. Operating margins, so that it factors in other rising costs like staff costs, things like that. And they have come down by a couple of percentage points in every case, whether it be Heinz, who's attracted a lot of criticism. I think even Tesco criticised them again this year. You know, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, companies like that. So there has been margin compression there, which doesn't necessarily equate to the theory that these companies are taking a bit extra for themselves. Obviously, shareholders would probably enjoy it if they were. I suppose the question is maybe, though, for me, what happens this year? Because it would seem more natural that the time at which companies can take advantage of this kind of thing is when their own input costs start to fall, but they are then slower to pass those price drops on. And really, once again, it's the likes of Tesco who are going to have to try and prevent that from happening, are going to try and have to press them very hard to make sure that these falls in input prices are passed on to the consumer via Tesco, via the supermarkets. So I don't know if you ever take Alex on the idea, you know, this is certainly a political topic of increasing significance, if not necessarily something that's going to run or develop any further.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, Hermione, who's away this week, she's written a piece for next week's issue on greedflation. I really agree with what she's written on that sort of diagnosing a true case of greedflation in all of this is quite difficult, and that we've had both the ECB and the Bank of England signalling their suspicions around some companies' habit of expanding profit margins, you know, without facing a significant loss of market share. But where the balance lies and the outlook for falling inflation, falling input costs this year sits, I mean, really, really, really hard to say. I mean, the one thing I think we can say is that, Chris touched on it at the start. I mean, Tesco's certainly not price gouging if you look at their margins relative to the consumer staples groups. I mean, their adjusted operating profit margin in the retail business declined 54 basis points to 3.8%, and that's a big fall for such a thin margin business. So, yeah, I mean, Pantheon Economics, I think, wrote something saying they're seeing evidence of supermarkets widening margins. I mean, I can't really see it here in Tesco's results. And their capacity to raise them over the next year, you know, going to be really challenged again. I mean, this is the perennial issue for this business. They're probably about as important to the UK economy and society as, you know, Ministry of Defence, the NHS. I mean, it's that important a business, but it's... how it grows, what its value is to shareholders, other than this, you know, enormous sort of deposit of assets and brand equity, is kind of hard to see. That's why the investment case, I think, is always, you know, a little bit tricky to make with supermarkets.
Well, one company which has seen a bit of margin pressure earlier this year is PZ Cousins. It's not directly related to food pricing, of course, though I'm sure there are some input costs there. But it had a trading update today, and actually the news is a bit better there, Chris. I mean, at the half-year stage, there were concerns about falling margins in the US business. They said at the time, I think, that, you know, the second half should see a recovery in that. And from the trading update today for Q3, that does seem to have been the case. Things are looking a bit better in the major markets.
Yeah, that's right. So this was quite a strong third quarter update from PZ Cousins. As was Tesco, the market responded favorably. The shares were up by 4% this morning after the update came out. Reported revenues were up by quite a solid 13.5%, and like-for-like sales were up by over 6%. The company mentioned a significantly improved margin in Europe and the US, and that should reassure investors on those margin pressure concerns that you mentioned. Getting into a couple of the segments, so it made quite an interesting acquisition last year, its first acquisition in a long time, of a brand called Child's Farm, which is a baby and child's personal care brand. And the company mentioned this is performing well. It's on track for double-digit revenue growth for the full year. It also mentions that the Saint-Tropez tan brands performed well, but also no surprise that the K-Rex hand wash brands sales fell again as volumes continued to normalize after the pandemic.
I should say, for those who don't know, the company most well known for the likes of Imperial Leather and personal hygiene products that obviously did very well during the pandemic. As you say, Chris, the acquisition of a Child's Farm, which I always feel I have to be careful to add that S in, because Child Farm is something very different. It's a bit of a strange name for a company, if you ask me. But the acquisition there and the Saint-Tropez, those kind of things are obviously quite different, and a sign of it, you know, playing into that burgeoning personal care market, which, you know, has nothing to do with the pandemic and has some structural growth trends behind it. Do we think this company, from a valuation perspective, you know, there's interest there for the investor?
The The standout line, I think, which got the market a bit het up this morning is, you know, they're talking about adjusted profit before tax to be at least in line with current market expectations. So they've had this Forex benefit as well, which is helped. But shares, you know, shares rose on what looked like a kind of half profit upgrade. I mean, it really is worth mentioning that this year's earnings forecasts, those market expectations that management is referring to, are down about 15% over the past year. So it's not quite the expectation beating statement that it sounds like. The other thing, I think one thing that investors could pay attention to with this company is the price to earnings growth ratio. So it's kind of a measure of how up to speed investors in the market are with the level of earnings growth in the business. And that's pretty high. It's higher than Tesco's, and Tesco's have done a better job at you know, improving their sort of underlying operating profit. Yeah, so it suggests that profit has, you know, that the profit that has flowed from sort of consistent sales growth for PC Cousins has been pretty well identified by investors. I mean, my take, I think shares are pretty fairly priced, if a little rich.
As is often the case with consumer staples at the moment, which is perhaps a testament to the margins they have been able to, if not maintain, then, you know, maintain at a higher level than perhaps some expected. But as we said before, there's quite a difference between that and gouging, shall we say.
Yeah.
Let's turn to a set of completely different sectors now with our cover story this week, because I think it's fair to say when we are looking for the next big market narrative, which is what the cover story attempts to do, that supermarkets, consumer staples probably aren't going to be it. That said,
you never say never.
This is a educated exercise in crystal balling, shall we say. So, as you say, never say never. But talk through the piece to begin with, Alex, because obviously we're coming off the back of this long era of low interest rates, you know, high growth companies flourishing. That's been ended for a while now, but we haven't really got through to a sense of what might come next.
Yeah, I mean, you could say this piece could have been written any point in the last year plus, really, because, you know, it's not a new story that interest rates are higher than they have been for, you know, the entire period since 2008-09, nor is the sort of preeminence of the tech stocks, I mean, you know, at one point colloquially known as the FANGs or the FAN MAGs or whatever you want to put it, you know, that story, that bubble has kind of burst, or that peak had been reached, and we can't see that necessarily returning. So, I mean, the backdrop for the story is essentially the story we're always looking for in the magazine, or investors are always looking for, which is, you know, what are the next big stories? What are the shares and companies which are going to break out and deliver above trend growth sustainably over the years? And I mean, the tech narrative has been so sort of dominant and entrenched for you know, the best part of the past decade and a half, that it's difficult almost to see what the next paradigm is. And, you know, it's a word sort of borrowed from Steve Eisman, the famous Big Short investor, who's recently been talking about what he sees as a paradigm shift in markets from a low to a higher interest rate environment, and what that does to investor risk appetites and the sort of sustainability of certain sector stories. So it's very hard to identify what the next paradigm is going to be. We kind of, you know, wanted to use the piece to sketch out a few of the possibilities and what might be required to sustain those new paradigms. But yeah, that's, you know, the investing is always a bit of a crystal ball exercise, and this is my attempt to capture the market mood at the moment.
Mm. Well, looking back, I mean, obviously it's not just tech. There have been, as you allude to in the piece, you know, not quite on a decade by decade basis, but there have been a series of periods in which there have been easily identifiable market leaders over the past X many decades. So that doesn't mean there's going to be one again, but it would very much be in keeping with the last 50 years, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a growth story somewhere. I mean, if we're going to shorten the era to the sort of mini drama of 2022, you'd say it's energy and defence and commodity stocks, which had a very good run. I mean, that's, you know, 1 year is not a multi-year growth story that the likes of which we're trying to identify. But we've seen those the circumstances for those sectors doing really, really well in the past. In the 70s, those were the sectors to own, really. And then in the 80s, there's a few stories going on. Japan was very big until it wasn't. You know, the 90s, maybe it's the era of conglomerates. And then we obviously had a bank sort of melt up before a very, very spectacular meltdown in 2008. And then the chapter that we've got very used to over the last, you know, 14 years. And then whatever comes next. And it might be a continuation to some degree. I'm not entirely sure myself of what we are quite used to now, which is very large, highly cash generative, intangibles rich tech companies, which find ways to exploit new large total addressable markets. Yeah, I think the jury is still out on whether they are going to just sort of fade into the background, with the big caveat that it's rare for the incumbent leaders of a sector to you know, keep their place.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what you touched on last year in energy there, and commodities are one topic we talk about in the piece. There are obvious drivers there theoretically when you look at things like, well, A, energy security, B, the energy transition. In practice, especially with a sector which can be pretty volatile and based on volatile underlying prices, is that something that could be achieved? I mean, it is something that we could see over the next decade. Right now, it feels like it would be perhaps a difficult ask, but often good investment decisions do feel difficult at the time they're made.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things why I think some people are very bullish on the setup for commodities, and maybe it's good, useful to actually boil it down to the specific materials we're talking about. So, you know, in oil and gas, you know, this has not been a fashionable sector to invest in for some time, because the long term demand forecasts are so uncertain. I mean, about 15 years ago, you know, the turn of the century, oil and gas companies were really rewarded for volume, for replacing their reserves at an ever increasing rate, and to you know, have the companies sort of valued on that basis rather than their ability to, you know, generate cash and return profits to shareholders. But there's been, you know, globally there's been an underinvestment in the space for a number of reasons, and that, you know, given that demand for oil and gas is not about to drop off a cliff, even though it, you know, that would be nice if we were able to transition very quickly away from fossil fuels, that has arguably created a setup where we're going to have shortfalls in the years ahead. That story is more acute, I would say, in the copper market, because we actually have a growth driver there. In the, you know, if we're going to electrify the economy, the global economy, if we're going to start to properly tackle you know, the climate crisis and the energy transition, then we're going to need an awful amount of electrification. Electrification requires copper. There's some estimates that the annual global demand over the next couple of decades has got to double. That's really an unprecedented step up in demand for such a fundamental global commodity. So the setup there being similar on the supply side, because there hasn't been the level of investment owing to difficulties of permitting, the fact that so much of the you know, the known reserves, the high grade ore, has been not only discovered but been exploited, means that we have potentially a significant shortfall, a supply demand shortfall in the coming years. So, you know, this month we've seen Glencore take a tilt at Teck Resources, big Canadian copper company. They're, you know, Glencore, for a company so almost contrarian in its bets on coal and, you know, some of its other operations, seems to want to be prepared to bet the farm and completely rip up its business structure in the service of going all in on copper, essentially. That seems like a pretty big signal that, you know, and together with other investments of the other, you know, diversified mining majors, that they all see this as a big bull market in the years ahead. So yeah, that's the long answer to the commodity setup.
Well, that's just one of the sectors that we talk about in the piece. Obviously, I won't go into them all now. Leave the listener hopefully wanting a bit more. But one thing I wanted to posit perhaps was, you know, what if the next story isn't about a sector but about a investment style, which maybe is getting too obtuse. But again, if the past decade has been about high growth, that's translated quite neatly into tech and all things tech. In an era of higher interest rates, you know, value investing has come back into vogue. Could it be we look back and say, oh, actually, you know, value stocks were the way to go? The second part of that question being, or is that easily, you know, distillable into certain sectors? Commodities, I suppose, in some cases, viewed through some lenses, are seen as value investments. Banks and financials are as well, albeit this is not the best time, perhaps, to be voicing that suggestion. But, you know, could it be that it's not a sector at all? It could be a style.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I mean, even though I tried to distill these factors through the stock screens each week, I think it's a very, very hard ask, really, to distill what we mean by value. Particularly of all the investing factors, value is the most ephemeral and elusive. And the reason being that what looks like value might be a very unstable earnings basis, so a base rather. So with the banks, yes, their net interest margins have expanded over the past couple of years, but there are trade-offs there, as we've talked a lot in the last few weeks, you know, on the liability side and what happens to their deposit base. Similarly with you know, I mentioned, you know, mining and the potential for a boom in the copper price. Well, what happens when prices rise? It attracts more supply into the market, so there's more investment, there's more you know, capacity expands. And at the moment, even, you know, if you look at the copper price, we're in you know, what's known as backwardation. So investors are, or markets are, pricing in the copper price to fall in the coming months, and I think the coming next couple of years, even though there's this long-term setup for you know, a really sustained demand story. So yeah, the quality of the earnings is the real component to value. And I suppose if you're going to compare that to you know, what we describe as growth in the sense we've got used to in these huge companies that get ever bigger, the sort of real component there is on kind of how you value those businesses. And if you think that the growth is sustainable and margins can be maintained, value stocks have historically have had a rougher time at maintaining and hanging on to those margins, hence their, you know, their discounted valuations. So yeah, I mean, in terms of style, I don't know, I wouldn't want to place a bet on you know, rule out value being a good place to be in the coming years, but then it really depends on how you define it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, really mealy-mouthed answer.
Well, it makes sense. So what I was going to end on is you know, in some ways the IC's mantra, which is true now more than ever, in that it does all come down to stock selection ultimately, which, you know, the discussion of value we've just had would point to as well. It ultimately depends on the individual business.
Yeah, and this is a really good point. Like, the, you know, we talk about paradigms, we get very, very carried away with these distinct narratives of, you know, the FANGs, you know, and within the FANGs there are multiple businesses with, you know, different ways to value them. They are doing different things. They're growing at different rates. They're on, you know, they have different margins. It's not a, you know, a monolithic story there. So in looking for the next big trend, and there will be the next big trend, I mean, it's inevitable. It's a feature of markets. Yeah, we should never overlook the fact that the stock market is full of very interesting businesses doing their own things. I mean, I sort of looked at the, you know, beneath the sort of market narrative, the companies which have been the most successful over the last sort of 14 years. In the UK market, I mean, there's three companies there which have, you know, performed terrifically. I mean, Get Games Workshop is one familiar to a lot of people. And then you've got Ashted and Four Imprint. So, I mean, you can't really fit the narrative of, a fantasy figurine retailer, an equipment rental farm, and the shipper of, corporate branded hoodies into a neat narrative. And yet, doing the mundane sometimes, it being very, very good in your niche is what it takes to, to be a serial compounder in the stock market. So, yeah, it's not always about the big geopolitical, complicated Federal Reserve interest rate stories. It can just sometimes be sort of good businesses doing things well.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, that is our cover story this week. There's a lot more detail in there about specific companies and sectors, so look out for that. But that does bring us to the end of the show today. So thank you to Alex and to Chris, and thank you to you for listening. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.